Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to turn the program over to Donald Abrams, MD, Director of Clinical Programs, the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, UCSF, who will introduce our distinguished speaker.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to introduce Philip Lee Miller. Dr. Miller is San Francisco born and a graduate of the centennial class of the University of California, Berkeley. He then went on to be in the charter class at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. After an internship, he did a year training in neurology and then has now become an expert in the new field of anti-aging medicine, one of the first to pass the boards in this young field, if I could say that, of anti-aging medicine. And has been doing a lot of thinking over the past years on the state of the healthcare delivery, if you could call it a healthcare delivery system as opposed to a disease management system in America, and is here tonight to talk to us and to give us some provocative thoughts on the future of medical care in this country. So join me in welcoming Dr. Miller.
I'm going to try this. I like moving around. It keeps everybody awake. I want to thank Bill Grant, especially for making this possible. This is a venue that I've been looking forward to for over 10 years. I think it's probably one of the most important policy forum in the United States. And what I want to show you tonight is a pretty ambitious presentation that's going to weave about three different threads. This is sort of, it'll be like a Seinfeld episode, or if you remember the movie Ragtime, it's going to have about three or four different themes, and we're going to weave these in and out. So everybody's going to have something here they're going to be able to take away. The bottom line is, what I'm trying to do is to show that we are in a position right now, and I timed this specifically to be a presentation about 5 days before the inauguration, because it's big. It'll be very topical. You're going to hear more and more about this, and it's time for those of us who have been thinking about this for over 30 years to have a voice in what does this healthcare system, what should it look like? And I'm going to show you what are the elements of it, where is it going, where should it go, what is being talked about, and how can we have some input. Where I lived for 25 years. Entitled this, The Future of Medicine. What is the future of medicine? Because it could look at, we could have a couple of different scenarios here. It really starts with the age wave. In the age wave, Ken Dickwald, in about 1987, so this is really quite prescient, in 1987 wrote, in the coming years, American culture will shift from being focused on youth to be increasingly concerned with the needs, problems, and dreams of a middle-aged and older population, us. The coming age wave will challenge and shake every aspect of our personal, social, and political dynamics. How we will alter ourselves in response will be an issue of mounting concern. Indeed, it may prove to be the single most controversial issue in the twilight of this century. The Futurist in 1993, healthcare facilities will be pushed to the limit in the years ahead by an increase in the number of elderly people. By 2030, the United States will have twice as many senior citizens as it does today, 70% of them women. And my favorite from Woody Allen, I don't want to live forever through my works. I want to live forever by not dying. What is the age wave? 76 million baby boomers. Baby boomers turning 50 at the rate of one every 18 seconds for the next 20 years. Always been on the leading edge. Will account for the greatest dynamic bulge. Redefining age, which is a treatable condition. And it may be the what we call El Dorado Shangri-La. Now, I want to show you something interesting. Watch this bulge here. Here's 1990. This is the United States. This is all over the world. 2010. See that bulge? 2020. 2025. 2050. See that huge bulge at the top there? So what we look at is between 1850 and 1985, when I first started doing this, we looked at this graph here, and you can see right here, life expectancy in about 1930 or 30 so was about 60. This is how Social Security was determined. It was determined on the fact that most people had a life expectancy of about, say, 65 by about 1938. So they figured, well, there'll only be about a two-year payout. And that way, the system will be self-sustaining, okay? Well, we're living younger. We're living much, much older now. And that still, we still cling to this notion that 65 is when you're old. So look at, here's what we call squaring of the curve, and we'll talk about this more later. Look at the growth of the population over 65. Look at the population over 85. This is percentage-wise. Look at the strain on Medicare. Look at all of this. And this is what we're going to focus on as Medicare, because what you're going to be told is what we really ought to have is a system that just essentially is a larger Medicare, and that's going to solve everything. Well, maybe. Look at the strain. Look at workers per Medicare recipient. Look at the decline there. That's because all those baby boomers don't have enough echo boomers to support us all. So you can see there's a declining base that's paying in, and you have to figure out, okay, what does that mean? And then you look at the trust fund. Now, this was from the infamous HCFA. HCFA is Healthcare Financing Administration, which is the organization that is responsible for administering Medicare. It is the government's medical system. And this was done about 1995, and it showed that it was going bankrupt about 2008. Oh, that was last year, wasn't it? So why didn't it go bankrupt? Then you look at this here, and there's a disparity here, and then you look at this here. See, now this is a more recent graph. This is, I think, from either last year, from, again, the Medicare Trustee Board of Trustees. And again, you can see right about here, which is now, is where expenditures exceed income. So how is this system staying afloat? I will give you a little hint. They're cooking the books. They've been doing this for the last 8 years. So you look at here, look at the growth here. This HI hospital, see how that gets bigger? So the Medicare shortfall, this is the trust fund report. This is 2008. So this is last year. This is pretty current. Hospital insurance trust fund expected to remain solvent for the next 10 years. But does not meet the short-range test of financial adequacy. Its assets are projected to fall short of 100% of its annual expenditures by 2013. If the annual growth in hospital expenditures averages 7% per year during 2008 to 2017 as expected, the hospital trust fund assets will fall to 39% of annual HI expenditures in 2017. That is what they're telling you. Is they're running out of money. How are they supporting the system? And here's more showing right about here where it falls below 100% of sustainability. Okay, so I'm riding in the car, and I'm keyed for this talk a couple of months ago, and I hear our friend the maestro, who's no longer the maestro, Alan Greenspan, giving Senate testimony, House testimony. And it was really interesting. What I have argued for quite a significant period of time, this is really lucid for Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan is never lucid. For what I have argued for quite a significant period of time is that we have underfunded Medicare, which is a very significant part of the numbers that you are concerned by, about half. In other words, in order to actually honor all the promises that are being made to the next generation, the baby boom generation who are retiring, we would have to either cut benefits by 50% or raise taxes to a point which will probably cannot fundamentally be sustained. And therefore, we are looking as the underlying meaning of these types of reports, we essentially promise to the American people far more than we can deliver. This is before they even try to enlarge it, which is what you're going to hear about. I am very fearful that unless we solve this problem before everybody retires, large numbers of people who will not be able to get what they are fundamentally promised still have time to make adjustments in retirements. But if we wait until the hammer falls on us with the inexorable grind of the numbers, I think we are doing a very great disservice to the American people. This was 2 months ago. This is really recent. So this shows you the a couple of years ago, the sector between public and private funding. This shows, and this is not exactly accurate, it shows private spending, public spending, and you can see out-of-pocket spending, it looks like it's going down. That may or may not be true. Now, here's what we're told over and over again. We're told, well, we spend more money in this country than any other country, and so what we need to do is become more efficient. We need to get rid of the inefficiencies, waste, fraud, and abuse. We need to get rid of the inefficiencies because look at this. Here's the UK. Wow, we're spending way more money. How come we're not getting as good a bang for our buck? So, and again, you see the same thing here. You know, over time from 1998 to 2005, here we are right at the top, right here, and everybody's down here. So what does that mean? Does that mean we have a better system, a more expensive system, a less efficient system? But you're going to be hearing more about what can we do about this number here. How can we get this in line with the rest of the world? So here we are, baby boomers. Now, what I'm going to do is, second thread. I don't think you can know where we're going until you know where we've come from. And what I'm trying to do tonight, one of the big things I want to do tonight, is I want to give you the big ideas in history. Because what we're focused on right now is minutia. It's small little ideas. It's wonky stuff. And what I want to show you is what have been the big ideas throughout history. So I've been spending the last 2 or 3 years just sort of in my spare time studying the history of Western civilization, history of science, and the history of philosophy of Western civilization. So let's take this real quickly. Short history of Madison, 2000 BC. Here, eat this root. 1000 AD. That root is heathen. Here, say this prayer. 1850, that prayer is superstition. Here, drink this potion. 1940, that potion is snake oil. Here, swallow this pill. 1985, that pill is ineffective. Take this antibiotic. And 2000, that antibiotic is artificial. Here, eat this root. Full circle. So here's primitive medicine. Here's a Mayan priest. Kind of looks like George Bush to me. Mayan priest. So everything was spiritual. It was out of the body. Everything was out there that affected us. And then Asclepius came along. This was the first of the Greeks. Became the first and the greatest of healers because he was the son of Apollo. For it is said the art of healing depends on divination, and it was after listening to his father's responses and oracles that he adopted different drugs to different diseases. Thus, he taught his own sons and others the use of healing herbs, which apply to them to running wounds and to which dry wounds and in what doses to administer drugs. The Greeks began thinking of health and disease as something within, not something that was without. And so here's Asclepius, and from that comes what we call this symbol here, which is actually a sign of healing, which became the caduceus, which is the main symbol in medicine. And you see various guises of this. Hippocrates, and it's Hippocrates of Chios, because there were a number of Hippocrates. And when we hear about Hippocrates, who was considered the father of medicine, actually what we know of is Hippocratic writings, because Hippocrates started a whole school of thought, and there was a school that probably went for an estimate of 100 to 200 years that it interpreted his writings. The oath, I swear by Apollo, the physician and Asclepius, and health, all heal, and all gods and goddesses, that according to my ability and judgment, I will keep this oath and stipulation. When we graduated from medical school in 1972, we had sort of the Geneva interpretation of this. With purity and holiness, I will pass my life and practice my art. And I want to focus on this word art. Where there is love of humankind, there is also love of the art of medicine. Galen. Galen came along. Galen was probably one of the only few Romans of note, besides the emperors, who actually began to codify medicine. And Galen was so rigid and so empirical in his writings that this persisted for about 1,000 years, and everybody had to practice Galenic medicine until the early Middle Ages. So he had an immense force in medicine. Then came along, and interestingly, at the fall of the Roman Empire in about 425, Europe fell into complete decline. And believe it or not, Islam rose. And between about 600 and 1300 AD, Islam was the source of medicine and astronomy and mathematics. And so Avicenna was one of the great physicians, and this came out of the Islamic tradition. Maimonides, in 1135. This is what's really amazing. Maimonides was a rabbi, he was a philosopher. He said, medical practice is not knitting and weaving and the labor of the hands, but it must be inspired with the soul, filled with understanding, and equipped with the keen gift of observation. These, together with accurate scientific knowledge, are the indispensable prerequisites for proficient medical practice. 1135. We need to get back to this. The oath of Maimonides. Eternal providence has appointed me to watch over the life and health of thy creatures. May the love of my art actuate me at all time. May neither avarice nor miserliness nor thirst for glory or for a great reputation engage my mind, for the enemies of truth and philanthropy could easily deceive me and make me forgetful of my lofty aim of doing good to thy children. Paracelsus came along in 1493. Paracelsus was the first father, really, of medicine, of pharmacy. He was an alchemist. He was a nut. But he went through all of Europe, and he got thrown out of one place out of another. I love Paracelsus because he was the great iconoclast. But he began to try to codify various elements and herbs in a way that became pharmacy. He was a rather bombastic name. His name was really Aurelius Philippus Theophrastus Bombastus von Holheim. He was my favorite guy when I was in medical school. The practice of medicine is a work of art, and it's because it's a work of art, it must prove its master. But how much each part is to be judged can be seen only from the work as a whole. It is the art that imparts its wisdom to the work, for through its wisdom, the art creates the work. Sir William Harvey was the first scientist and physician who came along and actually began to look at the body scientifically. Prior to this, believe it or not, they thought the heart was kind of a heater and the brain was sort of a cooler. And Harvey, through some actually brilliant discoveries when you look at what he actually did, because I never knew this stuff in medical school, he actually discovered how circulation flowed through the body through deductive logic. So he was an incredibly important force in moving medicine in more scientific forms. Descartes was important because Descartes gave us the duality of the mind-body. And we still suffer this. The mind is separate from the body. And how is that manifest today? You put down any psychiatric diagnosis, we don't reimburse that because that's the brain. We don't reimburse anything psychiatric. We still suffer from this mind-body duality. Sir Isaac Newton is important because Sir Isaac gave us mechanics, and we suffer from a mechanistic world. So at his time, the mechanistic view was an amazing advance, but it has its limitations in terms of how do we look at the body, how do we look at our world? Is it all mechanics? Is it all Newtonian? Semmelweis was another of my favorites because Semmelweis was one of the first, not one of the first, but probably the most infamous. Semmelweis went around And he observed that the rate of puerperal sepsis, which is postpartum death from sepsis, was about 30 to 40%. And he said, now this is very interesting. Physicians would go and they would do autopsies. They didn't have gloves in those days. They'd do autopsies and they wouldn't wash their hands and they'd come and immediately examine the woman. Now, doesn't sound very antiseptic, does it? And so he said, listen, gentlemen, all I want you to do is wash your hands in carbolic acid. And he did this, and the puerperal sepsis rate dropped from 30 to 40% down to about 3 to 5%. How do you think he was rewarded? Out. Out. People don't like advances in medical knowledge. How do we accept change? What fosters change? He was hounded out of one hospital after another. He died a raving maniac. Now there's a Semmelweis University in Hungary. He's a great man. He's now celebrated. Flexner is probably the most important physician in the United States. Virtually nobody knows about him. He single-handedly, and I mean single-handedly, this physician changed the face of American medicine. And it is what we experience today is all because of Flexner. Prior to Flexner, there were homeopathic schools, there were herbal schools, and he went around. He ended up becoming the chief of the Ford Foundation, and he was the one distributing the monies, and he therefore controlled grants to universities and single-handedly was able to completely change the face of medical delivery by determining which university, and we're talking about Harvard, we're talking about every great university in the country, would they be certified, would they get money, how was medicine going to evolve? So it behooves everybody to understand who Flexner was, a poor Southern Jew who became just a mammoth of a figure. People hated him because when he came in, you either died or lived by what he said. Another person, virtually, you could go around England, and I'll bet you 999 out of 1,000 people have never heard of this person, the father of British medicine, of the British medical health system. Henri Nijbeven, called the firebrand socialist. What happened was, after the war, obviously, Britain was devastated because of all the bombing, and the east part of London was in shambles, and it was kind of like what we're going through right now, which was an amazingly devastating time, and the economy was shaken, and how are we going to put everything back together again? They rewarded Churchill with the boot. Churchill saved Britain, and he was out. And the socialists took power, and Bevan became the first minister of health and started the national health system. And again, it behooves everybody to kind of understand what that meant. His theory was all medicine should be free, should all be free. So who are the players? Who are we dealing with? Business, benefits, COBRA. You're going to hear a lot about COBRA. Individuals, out of pocket. Insurance carriers, our nemesis. Pharmaceutical medical complex. Government, entitlements. This is what you're going to hear for the next year incessantly. And foundations. So here are the players right now. President, Daschle, Pelosi, Waxman, George Miller, Pete Stark. Pete Stark hates physicians. Max Backus, Edward Kennedy, Wyden, Robert Bennett. These are the main administrators right now. These will change, but these are the guys to watch. These are the ones that are going to have the heavy hands right now, who are going to be watching over what is going to happen. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi here from San Francisco will have a major input into this because she's Speaker of the House. Here's sources of health care, and you can see uninsured. This is the one we all hear about. Now, let me switch gears and talk about a little bit about where did HMO medicine? Where did employer-based medicine start? So a frequently cited management care pioneer is Dr. Michael Shadid, who started a rural farmers cooperative health care in Elk City, Oklahoma in 1929. Although he met with significant opposition from other physicians, with the help from the Oklahoma Farmers Union, he succeeded in enrolling several hundred families. These members paid a predetermined fee, and Dr. Shadid rendered his patient care. Also in 1929, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which is probably the most powerful department in LA, contracted with Drs. Donald Ross and Clifford Luce, Ross Luce, to provide comprehensive services for 2,000 workers and their families. Within 5 years, this doctor-owned and controlled group practice prepaid at the Ross Luce Clinic enrolled 12,000 workers plus 25,000 dependents at $2.69 per month. Kaiser came along because he was synonymous with prepaid health care. He was impressed with Garfield's program. During World War II, he set up two medical programs on the West Coast to provide comprehensive health services to workers in his shipyards and steel mills. When the war ended, Kaiser opened his plans to the public. I was one of the first members of Kaiser in South San Francisco, 1953. Kaiser Permanente began at the height of the Great Depression with a single inventive young surgeon and a 12-bed hospital in the middle of the Mojave Desert. On October 1945, Permanente Health Group officially opened to the public, taking its name from, and this is really kind of interesting, Permanente Creek. Where does that name, Kaiser Permanente, come from? Permanente Creek that flowed through Henry Kaiser's first plant in the Santa Cruz Mountains. In just 10 years, 300,000 Northern California members were enrolled in his health plan. Another important side of the story of managed health care was a staunch opposition of organized medicine and the American Medical Association. With regard to the prepaid cooperative plans, the AMA was opposed to any form of lay control over medical professionals. It rejected anything resembling the corporate practice of medicine. This is what you think of as the AMA now. This is what the AMA was. This is what you think of as now. That's not what they are now. As a result of these actions, the AMA was indicted and convicted of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act in its efforts to suppress the new plans. In 1947, the Supreme Court rejected the AMA's claims that medicine was a profession. How interesting. Not a trade to which antitrust laws did not apply. So in 1971, the Nixon administration announced a new national strategy, the development of HMOs. The federal government would establish planning grants and loan guarantees for HMOs. In adopting this policy, the administration was influenced by Paul Elwood, who argued the structural incentives, the traditional fee for service, had to be reversed in order to achieve positive reform. Why? Dr. Elwood coined the phrase health maintenance organization to refer to prepaid health plans that enrolled members and arranged for their care from a designated provider network. This sounds like a great idea if you're thinking about nothing but economics. Where have we come to today? Corporate medicine. Exactly what the AMA was trying to fight. Corporate medicine. Okay, so let's look at this. And this is, if you don't take anything away, this is takeaway point one. Current thinking and solutions today are all predicated on cost. Cost recovery, cost shifting, and not quality. Quality is what you want. It's all cost. So here's the HMO formula. It's really simple. It's a very simple formula. Capitation times lives equals revenue. So an HMO, the way an HMO grows is they're always looking for more lives because the capitation doesn't change. So they're always looking for more lives. 500,000, 1 million, 2 million, 10 million. It's all a numbers game. But what drops out of that? Quality. It's not in that formula. It drops out of the formula. They don't care. They'll tell you they do. The marketing people will tell you do. But it's not in the formula. The guy with the green visor in the back room, the one who's calculating the kinds that he needs to see, physicians need to see patients at the rate of one every 11.3 minutes, he's not concerned about quality. Do we care about quality? Can we define quality? Do you know quality when you see it? Most people don't. They don't know it until they see it. So they go from organization, physician, for the physician, looking for quality, thinking they know what it is until they find it, knowing that they never got it until they found it. We have other definitions of what quality is. This ought to be the central debate. What is quality? How do we maintain it? Are we losing it? Do we care? Do we really care? Do we care that my prediction is in the next year, you're all going to shop at 5 stores, Costco, Target, Walmart, and you get the other 3, okay? It's going to be down to that. Do we want that in medicine? This is really interesting because it shows, I've been arguing for the last at least 10 to 15 years that medicine's in crisis. Now people are beginning to realize, well, there is a crisis, but how do we define what that crisis is? Is it dollars? Is it quality? What is that? The interesting thing is this, I think this is the Pew Center, shows here that it's actually been relatively constant in terms of, do we want fundamental change or completely rebuild the system? And you can see about 90% of the respondents, it was pretty constant here, that we've been perceiving this for a long time. What do we do about it? Now it's become more acute because of the financial meltdown. Health insurance is the only insurance that you will ever buy that you expect an immediate payoff. This is what I talk about. Insurance actually follows the law of unintended consequences. Insurance is making everything worse. Insurance is the only one you ever want to pay off. Home insurance, car insurance, traveler's insurance, life insurance, you name it. There's no other insurance policy that you want to pay off. So what's happened is that insurance has become a club membership. And as soon as you get your insurance, you want to use it immediately. Problem is increasing the price of drugs. Focus on goals, not results. Focus on goals and results, not barriers. This is what I tell all my patients. Focus on goals. What do you want? Don't focus on the barriers. What do you want, and how do you get there? What do we need to do to get to the goal? Don't tell me about barriers. We can go under them. We can go around. We can fix that. Now, in 1972, I went to London with one of my classmates who's sitting here in the audience. And I did it ostensibly to, in a brief sort of way, study the national health system, British health system. And I came away convinced that the flaw in the British health system was what was killing everything, was not, at that time, what we were worried about was socialized medicine. What was killing everything was bureaucracy. So it doesn't matter who controls it. It's bureaucracy that kills medicine. And so, interestingly, we can use this model because you could look at the Bismarckian model in Germany, you can look at the French model, you can look at the New Zealand model, you could look at the Chinese model, you could look at various models, but probably a model that might be in our future would be the national health system. And because we have such an affinity with Britain, why don't we look at what has happened in Britain since Bevan, and how interesting, and in his twilight of his prime ministership, that Tony Blair was free to actually tell the truth and say what he said. And so here's Tony Blair showing a bowl of fruit. What did he say? Prime Minister wants to prevent illness rather than relying on the national health system to cure them. He told the Sun, anyone who looks after themselves is going to live longer. There is no doubt the national health system is overstretched, like every healthcare system in the world. But you can make a great difference if you take care of your own health. It actually pays dividends collectively. For 100 years or more, the dividing division in politics in Britain and elsewhere was about the role of the state, big government. Essentially, progressives believe in the ability to improve society. Conservatives feared that its interference stifled personal liberty. The division became caricatured as between those who favored a big state and those who favored a minimalist one. Does this ring a bell? Fierce struggles about nationalization or privatization, about the precise level at which public spending started to crowd out private investment, dominated the era post-war politics. Conservatives were for business, often big business. Progressives were trade unions in the public sector. And above all state that sees its role as empowering the individual, not trying to make choices for them, can only work on the basis of a different relationship between the citizen and the state. Government can't be the only one with the responsibility if it's only one with the power. The responsibility must be shared. And the individual help with an obligation also to help themselves. In 10 years' time, and if possible long before, I want the health debate in Britain not to be confined to the excellent national health system that treats people when they're sick, but to the broader national health service that is about prevention as much as cure, about personal responsibility as much as collective responsibility, and the quality of living as much as life expectancy. I couldn't have said this better. It is an ambitious goal, but one with totally in tune with the times. It means changes in government, business, and people, but that is the way the modern state should work. July 26, 2006, 2.5 years ago. This is from HCFA. What does HCFA think of preventive medicine? Harms of detection and early treatment. The U.S. Preventative Task Force found convincing evidence that treatment for prostate cancer detecting by screening causes moderate to substantial harms such as erectile dysfunction, urinary incontinence, bowel dysfunction, and death. These harms are especially important because some men with prostate cancer who are treated will never have developed symptoms related to the cancer during their lifetime. I might subscribe to that. There is also adequate evidence that screening process produces at least small harms, including pain and discomfort associated with the prostate biopsy and the psychological effects of a false positive test. The U.S. Task Force concludes that, now this is government speak, see if you can figure this out. For men younger than 75, the benefits of screening for prostate cancer are uncertain, and the balance of benefits and harms cannot be determined. If you are over 75, there is moderate certainty that the harms of screening for prostate cancer outweigh the benefits. You got to read this about 3 times to figure out what they're saying. This is what you're looking at. If you want single payer, if you want HCFA to run your system, this is what you're going to end up with. Stuff that makes no sense. Just like trying to fill out your income tax. It makes no sense. Medicine, now actually, it turns out, behind the door, closed doors. I actually sort of agree with a lot of this. But you cannot formulate this as health policy because it means every guy that I do a PSA on, Medicare won't reimburse because that's screening. The task force concludes that for younger men, anyway, medicine is a unique profession that is virtually... This is the final thing. Maybe we should ask physicians what they think about what's going on in the system. What I've seen over and over again in any change is the last person that's consulted are the people who are usually in that system. And I'm going to digress just for a second. I was in an emergency room in the late 70s, and they were doing a million-dollar renovation. And I was sort of kind of second in command. And they came in, and they were doing all this stuff, and nosy as I am, I asked to just look at the blueprints. And I looked at the blueprints, and I kind of looked at them, and, you know, really in detail, and I said, well, this won't work. You got these benches here, and you're not going to be able to sit under them. They're too low. Well, that's what we're supposed to do. They never asked anybody in the environment, what will work for you? So sure enough, they came, they built everything, you know, it was all finished. And of course, the first thing was, nobody could sit at the benches because they were too short. They had to come back and retrofit it. God forbid that you should ask the people in the environment. So what are doctors feeling? What doctors are feeling is a loss of discretion, a loss of control. Docs are depressed, really depressed, because they've lost the one thing that distinguishes the defining characteristic of a physician is some degree of prestige, but it is the ability to make decisions that affect people without being overly interfered with. Medicine is not the financial community. This is not Bear Stearns. This is not the meltdown. It is a different profession. Medicine is a unique profession that is virtually everyone comes in contact with at some point, at birth, in sickness, near death. Physicians play a role of vital importance in almost everyone's life. The Physician Foundation survey strongly suggests that this essential foundation is becoming unviable for those who practice it. As a consequence, many physicians will pursue a path that reduces patient access to their practices, inhibiting both quality of care and any effort to extend a healthcare mandate to more Americans. 94% said the time they devoted to non-clinical paperwork in the past 3 years has increased. 63% said the paperwork meant they spent less time with patients. 82% their practice would be unsustainable if proposed Medicare pay cuts were made. In other words, you're not going to get paid. 78% said there was a shortage of primary care docs in the United States. This has been confirmed. 49% said that over the next 3 years, they plan to reduce the number of patients they see or stop practicing entirely. And what's not in here, probably most of them would say they'd never have their children go into medicine. 60% would not recommend medicine as a career to young people. 42% professional morale is poor or very low. 17% rated the financial position of the practice as healthy and profitable. 17%. 6% described the morale of their colleagues as positive. 6%. Do you know how I deal with this? I don't talk to docs. It depresses me. So tell me something. What is national health care, single payer, going to do about this problem here or this problem here? Or the apotheosis of a society of affluence, this picture here? What is single payer? What is everything everybody's talking about going to do for these people? This is a big problem. This is a huge problem. It's a very big problem. This guy can't even reach it, okay? Here's the reason why. I'm going to give you a really simple answer why. Because in the last 70 years, actually in the last 40 or 50 years, food has become cheap. When I was a kid, we virtually never ate steak. I think it was like every 2 or 3 months. Food is too cheap. And also, we also know the whole story about, oh, supersize me, and they're trying to sell the little ones and the big ones. God, as a kid, I couldn't imagine someone offering me what kids buy today. It's enough for a whole football team. Here's the answer. Super President. I love this picture. This is a great picture, actually. This sort of reminds me of the pictures that you used to see of either Khrushchev or Stalin. You know, the great, or maybe Mao or something like that. It's a really healthy picture. But you know what? I actually like this picture. I like this picture because at least he's not on the golf course. He's not somewhere else doing something patrician. It's something that actually speaks to health. It's something that says maybe I actually might believe in what I say. This is what women are looking for. The quick fix. This is a great one, huh? Okay, what's the new paradigm? What am I offering? Can we move in a different direction? Do I have an answer to this? I want to set up what is the problem, where we come from. I wanted to show you that throughout history, that the word art of medicine came from the big thinkers. They didn't talk about cost recovery. They didn't talk about money. They talked about the art of medicine. And incidentally, docs think they're scientists or not. Physician uses science artfully. It's anti-aging medicine. It's adding years to your life, it's adding life to years, not years to your life. Here's what it's not. This is what I call regression to the mean. And it's not this. As poetic as this is. It's about quality of life. It's not about age. It's about no limits. It's about attitude, 80 years old. It's about vigor, 78 years old. Now, I'm going to show you in these slides here. These guys are all cheap because they all have really young, gorgeous women. But he's 80 years. He's almost 80 years old. And here's my favorite. Here's my icon. Here's Jack LaLanne. Here's one who was 81, spry 81. He's now 95. It's a new paradigm. It's about being forever young. How do we live beyond 100? And this is going to be more topical. We're going to go beyond Willard Scott, and we're going to see more and more and more centenarians. George Burns said, you know, once you get to be 100, it's you got it made. Very few people die after 100. John Glenn went into space the second time when he was 77. Look at his eyes. I want you to look at his eyes. Look at the focus there, okay? This guy is focused. 77 into space, second time. Sophia Loren, still probably one of the most beautiful women in the world. And what just shows is that for the first time in history, for women, once you turn 50, it's not all over. You can be gorgeous at 60, you can be gorgeous at 70, you can be gorgeous at 80. It's a total different paradigm. This has never really been true for women in the past, unless you, I guess you were an empress. Clint Eastwood, look at this. I think this is Rowdy Yates or something like that. What I love about Clint, I had been saying for the last 10, 15 years that Clint is one of the great, great actors and one of the great directors. You know, I loved him even from the beginning, when he did The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. But you can see every year, it's like, oh, this is the greatest movie Clint did. No, this is the greatest movie Clint did. Here's a guy like Picasso who keeps creating to the day, I mean, to the day he dies. This guy will keep creating, just like my favorite Brett Weston. These guys keep creating. Space Cowboys, a great movie because it shows here, I don't know if you saw this movie, but this movie was about a bunch of old guys who went into space and showed all the young guys who were freaking out because they lost it, that we needed some wisdom and age, and these guys brought it down. This is a great picture. Another icon, Sean Connery, look at this. Keeps getting better. Probably one of the sexiest men in the world. Again, my icon. This is a personal collection. Jack gave those to me. So I put these together to show you. Here's where he was at 16, 28. Look at this. I mean, at 41, the guy looked almost better than he did when he was 16. When he was 41, he looked better than 28. And here's at 68, and I'm going to show you when he gets older. This guy is the best example. He is a living laboratory. There's many of you who remember Jack jumping across the television screen in the 50s in his little black jumpsuit, looking kind of nutty. I always thought it was kind of silly, but I always thought, this guy's cool. This guy is a laboratory. Anybody who says, oh, vitamins are a bunch of, this is a waste of time. Anybody who says exercise is a waste of time. Anybody who said that eating organic is a waste of time. Here's a guy who's now 95 years old, and he says, I don't have time for arthritis. It wrecked my image. This is one guy who's a living laboratory. DeBakey, one of the first heart surgeons to ever do heart transplants. This is when he was actively still operating at 90 years old. Had a bypass when he was 96. They had to kind of push him into it. 96 when he had a bypass. He was still operating at 90 years old. Again, look at the eyes. Okay? Another icon. Again, the trick is to have beautiful women next to you. So here's George and Gracie, the love of his life. And here's when he turned 100. 100. Look at that. So you gotta have a gorgeous woman. This group here, this is a great group. Again, this is what we should be aspiring to. This is what I consider an epitome of longevity, despite everything you do to yourself, but not a good example of aging. Still, probably one of the greatest guitarists in the world. But probably you would never want to emulate everything this guy has done. It is amazing he's even alive. He's pickled. 115. Look at that. Look at her eyes. I love this picture. 115. We're going to see more and more people like this. This is what's happening. And maybe we're sliding a little, but as we become more affluent, we get to move up this here. So we go kind of, and this is economic gains, but I'm going to interpret this slightly differently, showing you that this here is really where you're in survival mode. I'm just trying to stay alive. And this is where you're into lifestyle. I want to thrive. This could be a country. It could be a person. This is where I want to be, is way out here. The question is, and the question that I'm trying to pose is, you know, is it all economic? Is it possible that even with, you know, you lived on a farm and you had meager income, you could still lead a healthy lifestyle? Aging is a treatable condition. It's not a disease. So let me show you transformative change. You don't want to do this without supervision. This is what we're all looking for. It's what I'm looking for. Here I am about there. And now can we just turn the clock back? That's the kind of healthcare system that you want. Ain't about money. That's the way back machine. Okay. So what is anti-aging medicine? What is it? What is a model that I have worked on, involved in, and seen grow from its infancy to today? What is this all about? It's goal-oriented. What is the goal? It's the toughest part I have with my patients. What is the goal? It's integrative. It means it uses the best of conventional medicine and the best of what people think of as alternative medicine. It's what I call enlarging a toolbox. It's using everything at your disposal. There are no limits. It's less confining. But you can't do this if you have algorithm-based medicine that says you can only do this. The insurance company says you can only do this. Remember, he who owns the ball controls the game. It is functional. Functional. And this is the second take-home message. Functional. Functional medicine means that we're treating and looking at disease or dysfunction in a different way. So we're not looking for disease, really. We're looking for, are you right? So dysfunctional means if you're menopausal or you're andropausal or you have any sort of a hormonal imbalance at any time during your life, or you have a thyroid problem or you have an adrenal problem, you do not necessarily have a disease. You don't have Addison's disease. You don't have Cushing's disease. You don't have a pituitary tumor. You don't have a disease, but you are dysfunctional. Men know this when their wife goes through menopause because men suffer more through menopause than women do. And vice versa. Women suffer their husband's andropause because he has not a clue what he's going through and he's wasting away. It's dysfunction. Can we look at a new paradigm that based, can we rejuvenate you and restore function? This is what physical therapists do. Physical therapists don't treat disease. They restore function. It's active prevention. So it's not just, well, yeah, you know, it's exercises and watch my diet. It's active prevention. It's a very complex set of preventive medicine. It is personal responsibility. Here's where we hark back to Tony Blair again. It's about assuming responsibility for your own health. It is about improved quality of life. It is market-driven. It is something that is from the bottom up. Market-driven means this is what you want, not what government wants or your employer wants or any other top organization. This is one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton's plan failed, one of many reasons why it failed in the early 90s. It was so wonky. It was so top-heavy. It was like, Arias says, First of all, how do you even follow this? It was all from above. This has got to be market-driven. Maximizing health span. Health span, even more than lifespan. How long can you stay healthy? So let me talk real quickly about theories of aging. There's the free radical theory, the wear and tear theory, hormonal enzymatic decline, cross-linkage theory, telomere theory. Telomeres are shortening. This is the basis of aging. There's modalities that we use, and these modalities are based on what are your expectations. They're based on exercise routines. They're based on nutritional medicine. How do I get you to eat healthier, better nutrition? Again, do you remember what you saw Tony Blair was talking about with the fruit? He got it. Hormonal replacement. You want to stay young? You got to look at hormones. That's how you stay young. Stress reduction. Stress leads to disease. But the father of stress medicine, Hans Selye, said it really wasn't stress, because we actually all strive on stress. It's distress causes disease. Distress is what causes cancer. That's why you see so many CEOs who are succumbing to cancer. You can think of a few right now. Distress. Stress reduction, brain longevity. We all want to prevent dementia. Spiritual pursuits. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's an outgrowth of the Enlightenment, 17th century. It's the Enlightenment. Can we get back there again? Other modalities is micronutrients, antioxidants, biologicals, here's the herbs again, enzymes, nootropic smart drugs, biological, bioidentical hormone replacement. I did that pretty quickly because I want to give you the model. I don't want you to focus on the components of it. The more important thing is, what should we be asking for? What are we driving for? What should this system look like? What do you want? What do you want it to look like? The hardest thing I have when patients come to me is the first thing I ask them is, what are your goals? And they start rambling on about this and that. What are your goals? And they finally, after about a minute or two, and focus on what do you want to achieve. It changes the entire encounter, because now we have a milestone. Because I come back to that, time after time. Have we achieved our goals? It's not about, okay, well, your diabetes is under control, your hemoglobin A1C is now 6.8, now 6.2, now 5.8, you're cured, you're out of here. It's how do you feel? Are you functioning? How are you functioning? How do you feel? Have we met the goals? What are the goals? So let me give you a little glimpse into the future of medicine, because that's maybe what you thought you'd hear. This is somewhat Newtonian, but it is futuristic, it is going to happen, and it is going to usher in a whole new era of medicine. And it has to do with stem cell, genetic engineering, telomerase modulation, microchip implantation, I made this one up. Life extension to 120 and beyond. This is where anti-aging medicine is going. This is the futuristic part of it. This actually could be 5-15 years away. It's not that far away. I have patients who come to me who say, listen, just keep me really, really healthy until these things come online. Because this is what they want. Again, they think something outside is going to make this thing better, make you better. You got to take care of yourself. Yeah, these things will, because stem cell therapy is going to be big. It really is going to be big. And finally, in a week, that policy will change. That policy will change in the first month. And stem cell therapy will be given much wider berth, because it is going to be huge. Schwarzenegger plan. I don't know where this is, but at the time I did this, who will pay? Who will decide? What about rationing of healthcare? That's what they talk about in Britain. Restrictions on choice. Timeliness of care. The Schwarzenegger tax on physicians, hospitals, and employers. ICD-9 codes are pathology-based. ICD-9 codes are pathology-based. Do you know who owns the ICD-9 codes? The AMA. Pathology-based means that if there's no pathology, it's really getting hard to code it, can't code it, can't get it reimbursed. So, CODA, solutions. We need a paradigm shift. This paradigm shift needs to be based on quality of care. It needs to be goal-oriented. It needs to be functional medicine, not structural, not pathology-based. This doesn't mean that I don't take care of disease. You got a heart attack, you get that taken care of. You got a broken bone, we take care of that, okay? The problem is, what this is all about is a huge reservoir that's increasing all the time of people who are not right. It gets bigger and bigger. It's what's pejoratively called by some theorists as the worried well. The worried well. Rejuvenation medicine. It's about bringing you back to where were you 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, objectively and subjectively. It's about energy and power medicine. This is actually, at a most biological level, this is mitochondrial health, which is a big area. We need to be looking at catastrophic coverage. Catastrophic coverage, this is what gets you. You are admitted to a hospital, $10,000 a day. That's what you need insurance for. You do not need insurance to go see your doctor every day. You don't really need insurance to pay for your drugs every day. Problem is, insurance has increased the cost of drugs, so now you actually do need your insurance to pay for the drugs because the insurance is subsidizing the cost of drugs. Glad I got a nod. Medical savings accounts, this is where employers set up a self-directed plan. Personal responsibility, I've talked about that. Health and wellness, again, Tony Blair talked about this. And you know, as if we could get every physician in this country to just agree to, in theory, their goal is to prevent hospitalizations. And I don't mean by phony methods, but I mean keeping patients really healthy so they never are hospitalized. You wouldn't need to change anything. That alone would save us trillions of dollars. If you could, that was a goal, is to keep people healthy, wealthy, and wise so that they weren't hospitalized. Now, this isn't fair. This isn't fair, but I'll tell you, in my anti-aging practice of over 12 years, I think I've had a total of about 6 admissions, 12 years, and I see tough, complex cases. I see the cases the cardiologists give up on. That's pretty good. If we could make that a goal. High deductible, low premium. Encourage bottom-up, not top-down solutions, and that's what's incumbent on every one of you in this room, is to kind of be an advocate for creative solutions, to foster creative solutions, foster the paradigm shift. And the last one that I could go on at length is to rein in state medical boards, which are preventing all of us from providing the kind of medicine that you want and you deserve, because it's not part of the convention. They are the keepers of the flame. They are the ones who say, no, that's not acceptable. It's like Patch Adams, and it's on and on. It's like Semmelweis. What is the convention? What do we believe in? What do we not believe in? So, in summary, I got Suzanne Somers to get this one. All truth passes through 3 stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident. We always knew that. Arthur Schopenhauer. It's about 1870. And it plays out over and over again. You're never too old. You're never too old. Jack is such a cool guy. It's a great book. Read the book. I really appreciate the time that I've spent with you. Hopefully I've gotten across some very important points. Hopefully this will be a focus of what can you do? Who can you talk to? Can we have an effect on what's coming down the pike. We are going through a financial meltdown. It doesn't mean that the medical establishment has the same solutions. It's not the same. It has different solutions. You cannot just say, fine, here's the TARP plan for medicine, you're out of here. I've tried to show you, we're running out of money. We need a different look. And for that, I thank you very much for listening, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of you.
Thank you for that very stimulating, provocative, and far-reaching presentation. Have a lot of good questions here. The first one I want to pose, going to the doctor means getting a prescription for some drug. No other choices are given. Medicine equals pharmaceuticals. How can medicine be weaned from drugs?
It's a great question, and it doesn't have a simple answer, because my theory is that physicians right now are under the gun. You know, the reimbursement, and again, all the algorithms are telling them, you have a limited time, and we're going to give you more patients, and we're going to give you less money. So he's only thinking one thing. It's called the hand on the door syndrome. The hand on the door syndrome is, I'm talking to you, the whole time I'm talking to you, I'm not really listening to what you're saying. I'm just getting a glimpse, and I'm thinking, what drug am I going to write to get you out of here? So that's the reason why you get prescriptions. And the answer is, it's not a simple answer. It's either you got to find a physician who has a different paradigm, a different mindset, or you got to ask for different alternatives. You've got to ask for a different result. You've got to ask for more time and consideration. You probably need another doc.
If I may, I live in two worlds of medicine. I'm chief of oncology at San Francisco General Hospital, which, as you know, we take care of everybody. And I'm also at the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, which is the UCSF Center for Integrative Medicine. And at San Francisco General Hospital, I treat cancer patients. I'm an oncologist. So I treat cancer patients. Tuesday morning, I see 8 to 9 patients in a half day. One to two-thirds are not speaking English, and I'm prescribing chemotherapy. At the Osher Center, I see 90 patient, new patient visits, and I've never written a prescription. So I tell the patients, basically, I'm dealing with the patient and not with the cancer. They have another oncologist treating their cancer. I'm treating the person with cancer. So, you know, it's a different system, and a lot of what you said really hit me home. Is the VA system a good model to build on for the overall U.S. healthcare system?
No, terrible system. Come on, that, you know the answer to that. Again, the VA system is good to the extent that you get something. But it's based, now, and I can't be too critical about the VA, because the VA is based on the concept, you served in a war. We deserve to take care of you. But how good do we take care of you? Our resources are limited. It's bad medicine. It's, to me, the VA system is sort of, you know, harks back to almost like, you know, the 1880s in Britain. The terrible hospital systems where nobody knows what's going on. You've heard these exposés. It is a system that provides medical care to everybody, but not very good care. I think what, you know, what I'm trying to tell you tonight is there is no one model. We are not a homogeneous society. There is no one model that's going to take care of people, just like you said. There's not a model that's going to take care of people in East Oakland, in Los Gatos, in San Francisco, in Marin, in Alviso, and in Los Angeles. It's not going to be the same model everywhere. It's going to have to be adaptable. But we have to allow for this adaptability.
Quick question. What are smart drugs?
Smart drugs are, you know, what they call technically nootropics. Smart drugs are any agents that improve cognitive function, make your brain work better. It could be as simple as Deprenil, which is selegiline. It could be DMAE, phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine. There's a whole host of these, but they're drugs or nutrients that allow you, that that enhance brain function. So it really increases plasticity of nerves. It may enhance nerve transmission, increases your ability to think more clearly.
Two other people besides myself had a question about hormone replacement therapy. As an oncologist, I'm a little concerned about that, and I've, as somebody who's interested in aging, I've studied DHEA and found that it really didn't do anything, which has been confirmed as well by JAMA publications. So the three questions are mine, and hormone replacement increases the risk of cancer, question, breast cancer, question, et cetera. And when do women, men start hormone replacement therapy? So there's sort of a dichotomous question.
Okay, well, that's a good question because now we can have a little tete-a-tete here. You know, in the literature, nothing is 100%. So you're never going to get anything that says, this is the study that proves once and for all this phenomenon happens or doesn't happen. What you look for is the preponderance of evidence. And it is really pretty well shown, and we can disagree about this, hormones do not cause cancer. They may promote it. They do not cause it. Cholesterol does not cause heart disease. It's been pretty well shown testosterone does not cause prostate cancer. Estrogen does not cause breast cancer. If it did, how come when women's hormonal levels are peaking in their 20s and 30s, they don't have huge rates of breast cancer? Why is it that men don't begin to develop higher rates of prostate cancer until their levels of testosterone start dropping like a rock? It's not accumulated exposure. It's not. It's not. See, this is where we can have a nice discussion here. The answer is this. It's not the hormones. And this is not what's going on. What's going on is as we're getting older, with breaks and deletions, our tumor suppressor genes are giving out. And so the breaks in the system, which is the P53 and the P5020, P27, and there's other tumor suppressor genes, they are giving out. That's what's going on. And so there's a loss of balance. And there's a loss of apoptosis of the system deciding what's foreign and what's not foreign. It is not hormones. Hormones keep you youthful.
So when do women and men start hormone replacement therapy then?
They can start, you know, usually women come to me, and probably the obvious age is probably somewhere after about 48, 49, certainly after about 50. As women are beginning to enter the crescendo phase of menopause, men begin to enter the crescendo phase of andropause between the ages of about 54 and 56. They manifest in different ways, okay? Why do women come? Because they are dysfunctional. They can't think. They have hot flashes. They can't sleep. They're depressed. They're out of it. The answer is not Prozac. It's progesterone and estrogen. Men have no lucidity whatsoever about andropause. It's the definition of andropause in men is they don't want to go see the doctor because nothing's wrong, and they really can't decide whether they want the hormones anyway, and the worse they can't decide, the more they need it. Andropause is... And people say male menopause, it's a stupid term. Andropause is simply as testosterone falls fairly precipitously after the age of 54 to 56, men begin to have similar but not the same manifestations as women. Depression, loss of libido, loss of motivation, loss of what I call centeredness, can even have night sweats. Bone density can be a problem. But that's not the main thing they complain of. It's dysfunction. We could have a nice discussion on this one all night. Okay. Because I'll tell you, no, because you could say after a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, at what age would you say it might be okay to put her back on hormones? At 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years? Never. Wrong.
My men with prostate cancer, I keep on their Lupron forever because you need to turn off the testosterone because that's what drives the prostate cancer.
And their androgen receptor upregulates and it gets worse. And they become androgen receptor.
So, all right. Let's take a question from the audience. Talking about dysfunction, at age 60 or so, some of my friends have trouble getting out of a car, but they don't change their dietary habits or exercise habits, or I guess buy a different car. And they are educated enough to understand. What do you do?
Well, you're right. Maybe you need to get it turned in your Italian car. There's a thing that we lose as we get older. It's called kinesthetic sense. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm just kind of pacing here. I'm doing that one just to kind of keep you off balance so you kind of don't fall asleep. But kinesthetic sense is just our sense of balance. And it's like as we get older, there's more of this stuff. You know, I'm watching TV, I'm laying in bed. And so we begin to lose that kinesthetic sense. And so falling down, breaking your hip is because you've sort of lost balance. And that's just movement. Movement can be walking, it can be tennis, it can be moving around. But maybe a part of the answer also getting out of the car is, you know, is sarcopenia. Sarcopenia is loss of testosterone and exercise.
What I read, I guess, when I saw this was my mother, a woman who's, you know, shrinking, and every time she gets in or out of the car, it's accompanied by an oi. So it sounds like oi is something you have to say to get in and out of the car. So I think it's my kind of issue here because we're talking about dietary habits or exercise, and people that should know better how to take care of themselves. It's like the children you showed.
The last person my mother listens to me is me. Okay. My mother is 85 years old. And you're not going to change that. There's a certain paradigm after a certain age you're not going to change. But you know, how do you change someone? That's why I showed you the examples of obesity, which is a major problem in this country. Simple answer to that, real simple answer to obesity, first answer, is we have destroyed our kids by taking away P.E. This is where Richard Simmons is a little nutty, but he's right. Kids don't have P.E. So what do? They have all this other, I don't know what they do, okay? But they don't have PE, so they're not exactive. So, you know, we got a whole generation of kids who are not getting that.
Yeah, I think the obesity issue, which you brought up, and which I think this question was hearkening to, is I saw on Larry King once, Mehmet Oz and Andrew Weil were having a little debate as to whether obesity was the individual's responsibility. And Mehmet Oz said, absolutely. And Andy, who's a friend and a mentor, I saw that was a split screen and his face went, like he didn't like that answer. And then when he got to speak, he said it's really our society where we subsidize corn so that we don't know what to do with it, and we feed it to animals and makes omega-3 fats, and we made high fructose corn syrup, and we subsidize food. You know, fruits and vegetables are expensive, and McDonald's is for $2 you can get all that trans fat and calories. So it isn't necessary. I mean, it is the individual in a way, but our society is, and we were talking before, I tried to change the food that we serve at San Francisco General Hospital once, just to see, you know, if I felt that if we could, for this socioeconomically diverse and ethnically diverse population that eats in our cafeteria, if they could experience healthy food, that it might really go a long way, but it was a failure. Impossible. So, yeah.
Unfortunately, you're a good example, okay? And we're a good example in this. I think it's really difficult to preach like Andy does about health and organic food, and you know what? Andy doesn't look the paradigm of health. Maybe he's thinner, okay? But, you know, a lot of my mentors who are well-known in the alternative community, virtually none of them look like this. They're all overweight. You got to look the part if you're going to tell people you got to eat better.
What are the simplest and most efficient ways to maintain one's health?
Well, it starts with personal responsibility. It starts with eating better. You could talk about high fructose corn syrup. Carbohydrates really are destructive. And virtually everybody will lose weight if you moderate the carbs. So I don't care whether it's Coke, whether it's chips, whether it's bread, whether it's rice, whether it's potatoes. You moderate carbohydrates. That's a big deal. I tell everybody, my mantra is protein up, carbohydrates down. The high fructose corn syrup is really, I will agree with Andy in terms of sociological phenomena. It is incredibly destructive, and it may be one of the etiologies of Alzheimer's disease. You know, I was going to put this slide in because I always get asked this question. You know, when I'm on a radio show, and I'm not real good at giving that one little soundbite. I'm not quite as bad as Carrie, but so I came up with about five things, and people don't like this, so this is a real challenge to you. So, what are like five or six things you could do today that will immeasurably improve your health? So, one of them is take chlorine out of your water, get a dechlorinator in your shower, because chlorine is really destructive. It's an antioxidant. It is an oxidant, and it's really destructive. Two, don't microwave as much. I'm not going to tell you never microwave, because maybe we have to. Don't microwave as much, but I got a little secret. Never, ever, ever, ever microwave in plastic. What you do is you take a Pyrex bowl, you put it in there, and it actually cooks it the way it's intended to cook, heats the water, and the food will say it tastes actually pretty good. Never, ever microwave in plastic. Even bottled water, I never drink tap water, but even bottled water, I'm getting more and more concerned, so now I drink San Pellegrino because it comes in bottles. I think cell phones are really destructive. I think cell phones, you're going to disagree with this, I think cell phones cause brain cancer, but it's worse than that. I think cell phones are really accelerating poor focus and accelerating short attention span in our society. Because everything, wait a second, I get my phone. You got people in the supermarket. You got people going to the bathroom. You got people coming in and out of offices. They got to answer that phone now. Do you realize that 15 years ago you went home and you answered your answering machine? Now it's got to be answered instantaneously. This goes back to the rat experiments where the rats are kind of going like this and they go like that and they finally it's like, and they die. Because you're always on. It is destroying your brain. And the thing that's really destroying me, I'm going to say this because this destroys me. I see young people. There's no young people in here. I see young people. I see it's either a couple or it's, you know, four girls. And they may be like 16, 17, 18, it could be 20, 22. Okay, and they're walking down the street. So there's a good-looking girl and a guy, and they're walking down the street, and they're both on their cell phone. They're on their cell phone. This is nuts. It's like, I got a great idea. Here's a novel idea. Why don't you talk in real time to him? Here's a novel idea. So this is really, it is affecting our communication skills, our ability to communicate. Everything is now, every like Twitter and all that stuff that people do, and texting, all that stuff, going like that. I don't even know how they do that stuff. My son said one guy actually had his thumbs, you know, little transplants in there to do that little texting. So don't do cell phones nearly as much. You don't need to answer every call. You don't need it as much. I actually forgot my cell phone. Do I feel naked? No. I'm glad it's not here. Those are a few. There's others.
On the other side, what role do you see?
This is really important. Because I'm focusing on this more and more. I have to kind of remind myself of it. It's really simple. You got to get 8 hours of sleep a night. You cannot function on less than 8 hours of sleep. A few of you can, and maybe you're Alexander Graham Bell. But you know, I have been conscious of this because I used to do emergency medicine. So I had this little clock in my mind where I was kind of adding up the hours I was losing sleep, and at the end of the week, I'd say I got to catch up on about 3 or 4 hours sleep. So I've always been conscious of this. But I don't know what it is. Now that I'm older, I really got this down. If I get 8 hours sleep, I'm good. I get 7 hours sleep, I'm off a little. I get 6 hours sleep, I'm sweaty. Just like what I remember when I used to work in the emergency room. Less than 6 hours sleep, I'm only thinking of one thing the whole day. I got to go home. I got to go back to bed. There are people I see that are so chronically sleep deprived, they're getting 5 and 6 hours a night, every night, year after year after year. That will lose you probably 5 or 6 years in your life. Sleep deprivation is a big one. If you look at all the centenarians, the things that are common about the people who live to long age, the centenarians, is that they get 8 hours sleep, they work late in life, they have a positive attitude about what's coming tomorrow, they eat breakfast. It's common to all of them.
I just want to just expand on the microwave. I live with a macrobiotic chef for 15 years, and our microwave was thrown out 15 years ago. So, and we used to drink Gerolsteiner water because it has 10% of the calcium needs. I don't do dairy. And now they put it in plastic, so we also don't do that anymore either. Carbohydrates, you know, I'm not one that believes that these diets that eliminate one macronutrient are the best way to go. So, you know, I think carbohydrates are important for us to fuel our brain, and I wouldn't blanketly, you know, damn carbohydrates. Science and health education are way too low to assure or assume personal responsibility. Popular medicine and drug ads are the primary source of medical ideas for most. What to do?
I'm not sure I understand that question. You know, we have a thing today called the internet. And it is so easy today as opposed to 10, 15 years ago. If you want to know answers, I mean, it's really common today. I know you know this. It's really common today. If you got you got amyloidosis of the kidney, or you got some really rare thing, it's really easy for you to be way smarter than your doc. You can do the education. You can find the answers. You have to look for it. You can find the books. You can find it by looking online, talking to other people. But if you're motivated, you can find answers. And this is what I'm trying to foster. I want people not necessarily to tell their docs what to do, but part of what this is about is more collaborative medicine. I'm working with you on this. I'm not here to dictate to you.
What role do you see molecular diagnostics, particularly those targeting advanced or chronic diseases, in the new medical paradigm?
I have a problem with molecular diagnosis. One of the things that's real popular today are things called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. And the problem with that is, you know, there's no one gene for aging, or there's one gene for diabetes. Again, that's the Newtonian approach, very mechanistic approach. You're going to see, well, actually, it's a constellation. And even the single ones, like, it's well known if you have the ApoE gene, that if you have an ApoE4E4, you're supposed to have 90% chance of having Alzheimer's. Well, maybe not. And if you have what I have, which is really rare, an ApoE2E2, means you'll never get Alzheimer's. So how come I can't remember everybody's name? But I have terrible problems with triglycerides. That is a single nucleotide, but even that alone, you're never slave to your genetics. And that's my problem, is that you're never slave to your genetics. The people that I see most are people who have bad genetics, and they're trying to make it better. You can take good genetics and make it worse. You can take bad genetics and make it worse. But what I'm trying to do is, how do you make bad genetics better? It's not written.
The final question we have are, what are some good resources for holistic health, I guess, other than the Los Gatos Longevity Institute and the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine?
That's a good pitch. That's pretty much it. You know, Life Extension Foundation really has good literature, good magazines. There are other organizations that I belong to, like ACAM, American College for Advancement in Medicine. But again, if you search, you can find these. To give you in one book or one source, it's a variety of sources, but it's all out there. I mean, you can even start with Suzanne Summers' books and then branch beyond that, because she'll give you the good basis. I'm really good friends with Suzanne. Suzanne's a great person. Suzanne is simply taking her fame and trying to write books that are trying to educate you and make it accessible. And then it's up to you to say, what do I do with it? How do I now go beyond this? So the information's out there.
So I'd like to thank both Donald Abrams and Philip Miller for their comments here this evening. And we'd like to thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 160th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.